So I've got something exciting to share. My book, What Are You Thirsty For? Rethinking Alcohol and the Life You Want, is now available for pre-order. It's about rethinking your drinking, not because you necessarily have to, but because deep down you know there's more waiting on the other side. It's about creating space for clarity, for calm, and the version of you that doesn't need alcohol to cope. So if you're looking for a refreshing take on alcohol identity and desire, just tap the link in the show notes and pre-order. Right, let's get on with the episode. Welcome to the Big Drink Rethink, the podcast for anyone questioning their relationship with alcohol or simply wondering what more life might hold. I'm Anna Donaghy, alcohol mindset coach, author, and former strategist. And each episode is going to blend lived experience, psychological insight, and powerful tools to help you understand your habits and gently rethink your drinking in a way that throws open oodles of possibilities. So whether you're trying to quit, cut down, or you're just plain curious, then you are in the right place. Let's rethink things together and explore what you're really thirsty for. So hello and welcome back to the Big Drink Rethink. So in recent episodes, I've been talking a lot about reconnection and how as drinkers, through alcohol, we can become distant, not just from ourselves and our emotions, but our values as well. So I am, well, delighted to be joined in the studio by Lauren Bernison today, whose story and insights make her the perfect guest to discuss this with. After giving up the booze 9 years ago, Lauren was inspired to create We Love Lucid, one of the world's first sober travel companies. Passionate about sharing the message that travel without booze can be a life-affirming experience, Lauren has been instrumental in pioneering the sober travel movement. Her company has been mentioned and featured globally in National Geographic, The New York Times, CNN Travel, to name but a few. But Lauren is also a passionate writer. She has a very popular newsletter, which I urge you to follow, which shares her experience of life as a sober single mum, along with pre-sobriety anecdotes and a raw and very engaging style that we're going to talk about in a bit. She is a huge fan still of off-the-road or off-the-beaten-track travel and is currently getting ready to head off on a campervan trip around Europe with her four-year-old daughter, which sounds amazing. So lots to discuss, lots and lots of stuff to get into. So welcome to the show, Lauren.
Thank you, Anna, and thank you for that lovely introduction. I sound as though I've been out on the lash. I'm dealing with a croaky throat here myself.
Well, you and me, and what listeners don't get to see is we've just spent half an hour talking to each other anyway, trying to get the microphones and stuff to work. So I feel like I've done the whole podcast already. Okay, cool. Let's maybe start with your story, because I've met you off camera, off screen, and I think you're fascinating. I love your writing. I love your newsletter, and it gives a real sort of picture into your life. And I'd love to start with your story so that listeners can sort of conjure up that picture as well. Can you take us back maybe to the beginning and what alcohol looked like in your life, your personal life and your career before you stopped drinking?
Yeah, it's funny you say career. I was never really one of those people that was able to, you know, excel in my career when I was drinking. But I suppose we should begin at when I started drinking, when I started really enjoying it. I never really felt like I fitted in. And I know this is such a common thing you hear sober people saying. And alcohol for me, first of all, was fun. I started drinking in the 90s when I was around 13, 14, which is quite common then. It was fun. It allowed me to just be someone else. I never really felt that comfortable in my own skin. And yeah, it just gave me this sense of aliveness. It really just, that was the key for me. And like many other people, I just took it a little bit too far, let's just say.
What kind of age were we talking about?
Yeah, so I started drinking things like Bacardi Breezers and Hooch when I was about 13 years old. And then I was a big weed smoker. And of course, I mentioned that I didn't really fit in. I was one of those creative types, but I also was quite sporty. So I was immersed in that mainstream kind of world too. Lots of mean girl situation going on in school. I didn't enjoy school. I felt it was really hard for me to get on with the girls there and experience some bullying and isolation. And yeah, I just had a very negative view of myself. I didn't like myself. I thought there was something wrong with me. And alcohol helped that. It just helped me. I found it easier to exist, easier to be in the world.
It's a common story, isn't it? And, you know, the degree to which things like bullying show up, or just a sort of chronic lack of confidence, or huge amounts of self-doubt, or, you know, perceptions of where you sit in a family structure and things like that, you know, it's that sort of early teenage, you know, sense of anxiety and desire to sort of escape. So I guess in a way, although I think your story is not very typical, in a way, what we're talking about there in a sort of teenage scenario is alcohol playing quite familiar roles, you know, self-confidence, escape, a little bit of just shutting out the bits. And actually, let's face it, when you first drink hooch or Bacardi Breezes or whatever at that age, it's that sort of feel good. It's like, okay, this feels nice. It feels different. It takes me away for a while. Yeah. So I think there's going to be lots of things running through this sort of story that show you up to be a sort of a non-conformist, you know, not just, you mentioned there, you didn't sort of go into a typical corporate career or, you know, pursue the sort of, you know, what you expected tick box structure of life. You've built so much of your life actually, and so much of your story evolves around travel. So where did that wanderlust come from for you? What do you think it was feeding in you all those years?
Yeah, well, from an early age, I always noticed this, you could say, the curiosity or this craving just to get out there and to go somewhere and try something different and get out and explore this world. I spoke, I was born with a natural gift for languages, which I realized when I was in high school. And I had this teacher, her name was Miss Beggs at the time, and I loved her class and I loved her. And she used to talk about Spain and, you know, in a way that she was obviously very very passionate about it too. And so whenever I was 15, I asked my parents if I could go and go to Spain and do this. I didn't stay with the family, I think it was, and do this sports camp thing that I did. And that was really my first experience of this kind of freedom. You know, I remember getting on the bus one evening. I was traveling from Salamanca to Madrid, and got on the bus. The sun was setting. I was listening to Moby, you know, this Moby album. Mm-hmm. You'll know this play album in my compact disc player. And I was sitting looking out the window at this beautiful tangerine sunset, just heading off into the plains of northern Spain. And I'll never forget that sense of freedom. And I realized at that point that I want more of this. Mm-hmm. I just wasn't happy with the options that were being offered to me, of school, then university, you know, all the while people telling me what to do, parents telling you what to do. And so that was the beginning of it, really.
So I guess in a way it sounds, you know, sort of, I was going to ask, you know, what do you think you were seeking through these journeys, through your travels, but it does sound like it's that sort of freedom and escapism. Did you feel that you sort of didn't want to launch into a more sort of structured career at that point? Or did you in your heart of hearts think that was never, never going to be you? I mean, this was more than a gap year, wasn't it? This was more than just to kind of, I'll go off and have some fun for a bit and then come back and get myself a job for, you know, an office job.
So when I did go back to school, then I did my GCSEs and my Spanish and then my A-levels. And you're talking about then that period when I went off to South America. Yeah, you know, I knew that I was a gifted linguist, and that whole path just seemed boring to me, the regular path that everyone was doing. And that's why I took that, you know, quote unquote gap year out. My idea was to become an interpreter after, but I didn't really understand what that entailed. I just knew I was good at languages. That's what I signed up for in uni. And right now I'll head off to South America to volunteer or help people, which is something that I have always been really passionate about. But I was also at the same simultaneously very passionate about my own emancipation from adolescence and being told what to do, and this passion for travel and also numbing out. So yeah, I got into to coke over there in South America. It was very cheap in Argentina, and I got into that in quite a big way. So it wasn't your regular gap year. I got into all sorts of trouble. You know, I was hanging about with a group of guys around the streets, and you know, at one stage a gun was pulled out, and it was just the, you know, tip of the iceberg. But yeah, that was a pretty crazy experience. But at the time, I was, you know, apart from the come downs, that was freedom for me, and I was thoroughly enjoying myself.
It's really interesting, isn't it? Because you sort of think, you know, alcohol and travel and drugs are very, very present in your life, potentially as part of the culture that you are sort of moving through. You talk about sort of South America and coke being really cheap and stuff like that. But I suppose, you know, travel, drugs and alcohol sort of feeding your curiosity, really. And I guess they become inextricably linked with a sort of connection to a place as well. You know, I suppose you look back now and that was your defining experience of South America at the time. And did you kind of find that the sort of the alcohol, I know this might sound a bit of a weird question, but did you sort of find that the alcohol sort of fueled the travel, or how were they related? How did they kind of intersect in a way?
Yeah, so for a long time, I pathologized this whole thing about traveling and wanting to escape. And, you know, and that's also why I drank and things like that. But, I've worked out that life's not really that black and white. I love the feeling of exploration, and I still do. And that's what I loved at that time as well. The alcohol, that gave me a certain kind of experience when I was over there, which was usually a dangerous one. But it also allowed me to be character. So whenever I went over there, people didn't know me. So whenever I was drinking and taking coke, I was this different person that allowed to be someone else, not this insecure girl that I was underneath. And anytime I went away, I was like, right, this time I'm going to be, you know, this person that everyone likes. And I tried to use alcohol and drugs to be, well, I ended up using them anyway. And it was actually the opposite. You know, I became pretty goddamn repellent when I was an alcohol and drug. People, you know, people used to run a mile. I get it. But so it was actually, it had the opposite effect. But I don't know, because now I do that kind of travel and I don't drink, and I really still love the exploration side of it. But I suppose it just helped me connect with those around me more.
I do hear this, you know, from a lot, in a lot of conversations, not obviously always used in the context of travel like that, but we know that obviously alcohol, drugs, you know, it's a way to connect, and it's a way to assimilate into cultures, and you can feel, it's a bit ironic in a way, because you can feel like you found your tribe and you can feel safe in that place, even though it's quite an edgy and sometimes very dangerous. You sort of look back now at some of your experiences in South America, you probably think, oh my God, the danger that I put myself in, or the risks that I exposed myself to, yet at the same time, you somehow felt strangely safe because you were with other people doing a similar thing and protected in that sort of, in that bubble. But I guess, you know, at some point, as you say, things begin to shift. So when did alcohol stop being something that felt like fun? You just said it started to feel like something a bit more repellent rather than something that was connecting, something that was bringing you close to others. How did you start? When, I suppose, did you start to feel it as more of a source of disconnection?
Yeah, that's funny, because that would have been pretty soon after I started. I mean, when I went to South America is when I started taking hard drugs, and it was obvious then. I was only 18, but I used to drink wine there, that horrible box wine, just to come down off the coke, because it felt so crap, you know, because I felt so awful, and I had a really, I knew that something was not right. So that was very early on. I suppose what changed over time was, at the beginning when I started doing it, there was more fun, and over time the fun became less fun, and then more chaotic and more unpleasant, the whole thing. With regards to being repellent, I think I was pretty much repellent the whole time. I was drinking and taking drugs from a young age anyway, just because of the way it made me, the whole, you know, I had a heightened dopamine response to drugs and alcohol, which means I was very leery, very rambunctious, loud, big risk taker. So, yeah, that's what I'd say.
And you were becoming more aware of that, or were other people making you aware of that? Or were you just finding yourself in situations where it was bloody obvious that, you know, things had gone haywire? Or did someone take you aside and go, mate, listen to me, have a word?
Yeah, I mean, people did, South Americans even mentioned it, and that was saying something, you know. yeah, because I was quite young, and yeah, people definitely did mention it. I was taking coke probably 5 times a week at that point when I was 18 down there. And, you know, to me, it was just a casual gram or two out with my friend walking around the streets. It didn't seem that big a deal. But yeah, I realized that it was, at the time, especially the come downs, you know, they're pretty horrendous. I remember I used to have this photo of my mom and dad pinned beside my bed. And I always just, it used to get me really emotional. I was coming down, I was looking at the picture, and they didn't really know what I was up to over there. But
what did they think you were up to over there?
Well, you know, I have to praise them, give them praise for this. They allowed me and helped me to get over there and pay for my flight, for example, mm-hmm. and helped me with some spending money. I also did have a job. Like other people my age, we worked from like 13 years old. So they allowed me or facilitated that trip to South America. When I got to South America to do the volunteer work, it was with a church. The church threw me out after 2 weeks. They said I was not the type of girl they were looking for. I hadn't actually really done anything at that stage. I hadn't started taking the coke or anything. So they just told me I had to go home. And my parents were worried. Of course, they said, yes, come home. And I said, no, I'm not coming home. I really don't want to come home. I want to stay here. I'm not cutting this adventure short. And they allowed me to stay out, which, you know, looking back, you might think, oh, well, that was a terrible decision. But it wasn't, because they knew me and they knew that I really, it was important for me to stay out there. And so they knew I was just going from, you know, staying with different people or whatever. But they didn't know that I was, you know, caning it to the extent that I was.
And when did it kind of... When did it come to an end for you, Lauren? You know, what sort of a, you know, you've mentioned to me about sort of hitting a kind of rock bottom. Was this a physical as well as an emotional and social? And what did that look like for you?
Yeah, so, you know, that trip ended quite badly. I got into various different problems there with different people and ended up having nowhere to stay. And oh, goodness, just, and other, you know, unpleasant things that you can associate with being a young female somewhere like that. And but I continued to do this kind of experience throughout my 20s and early 30s, where I would come home, tail between my legs, save up money, couldn't bear it in the UK anymore, boring, headed off to another country, you know, the more dangerous, the better. And kind of repeated that cycle. And then I eventually went to South Korea, not dangerous, admittedly, to be an English teacher. And there they didn't have recreational drugs at that time, or it was just not common at all. So that's when the booze really took over. And usually for me, I'd never experienced blackouts because I was always in the uppers, which meant that you don't have blackouts. You kind of remember more or less what goes on. You're awake the whole time. And this wasn't the case with the alcohol. It was an absolute nightmare. In fact, I don't know how anybody sustained decades of that, because for me, that was my almost shortcut to sobriety, because it was booze, blackouts, oh, nightmare. Yeah, I ended up getting into trouble there. I had to go into police custody. I'll not probably get into any more detail about it there, police protective custody. And it just scared the crap clean out of me, to be honest. I was like, I am trapped. This is the scaredest I've ever been. What am I going to do? And some people say, well, why didn't you just go home? And this is a conversation I had with somebody else recently who was like destitute in Kazakhstan in a prison, still didn't want to come home. And there's something about not wanting to give in, or want, you know, that being the weak decision, even though you're in the shit. And anyway, so I stayed in South Korea. That was my rock bottom. I realized that my life was just, you know, getting exponentially worse, more chaotic, and that I could easily end up dead, if not because of the kind of people that I'm hanging around with, but or the effects of alcohol in my body.
Yeah, what you were doing to yourself.
Oh yeah, like I didn't give a shit. And so one weekend I just decided I was about to head off on this group trip to off to some island. These were things that I'd been trying to incorporate into my life, you know, these wholesome kind of activities. And I just thought, right, I'm going to try not to drink this weekend. And I haven't drunk since.
Was that it? That was it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Was it?
Yeah.
Was it a decision made before that weekend and then stuff happened on the weekend that helped bed that in? Or was it literally, so it wasn't a nature of the retreat or the trip you were going on. It was just that was it for you. You just thought, I can't go any lower. I can't do this anymore. I'm not going home. Got to sort this out. Got to sort this out.
Yeah, I just could not see a way out of it. I was, I just thought, right, I need to try this sobriety thing. And I remember speaking, I don't, maybe emotional because I'm mentioning my mom. She is still alive, by the way, but she, on the phone, she said, you're going to have to seriously think about stopping this. And she knew me, you know, you don't say that to drinkers rarely because they're just like, oh, whatever. But it was a serious conversation this time. And I think actually on that particular day, I'd been out, you know, in some dive bar with a bunch of Chinese dwarfs. And that sounds like it's not true, but it actually is true. And one of them, yeah, I know.
Sounds like the start of like a joke.
No, like... I know. And that's why I love telling a story. I hope you don't edit it out. and yeah, one of them had this like, this Chinese, people think that East Asians are these like feeble, you know, they are big drinkers. He had this contraband booze, the thing in his pocket, and I drank that with him. Really nice guy, you know. And well, there's no reason why I wouldn't be, just because you're war. And anyway, so I drank this with him, and the next morning I remember I woke up and I had this burning sensation in my stomach. It felt as if I literally burned a hole through the lining of my stomach, and then I couldn't keep food. Well, so I was having certain symptoms, and I looked it up, and you know, this pancreatitis thing came up, this pancreatitis, and I thought, oh my goodness, so I actually could, you know, I could die if I continue. And that was also apart from the crap with the police and the, you know, the psychos, that was also one of the things that made me stop, the fear.
And how easily did you find that? How easy did you find it? I mean, you seem like a lady who puts a lot of determination into everything that she does and doesn't give it up, and you know, doesn't throw the towel in, and you know, there's clearly a certain sort of a will and a conviction about you. Did you find it an easy process once you had made up that decision, or did you find you went through a period of quite long withdrawal given what your activity had been like up until that date?
You know, there was a couple of different things that contributed to me being able to sustain that decision not to drink. And the answer is I don't know. It honestly feels like some kind of some grace that, you know, was present in my life at that time that allowed me to do it. But when I headed off on that trip, I met a guy who sat down beside me. And I remember thinking, oh, God, I don't want to sit beside anyone, you know, on the bus, you know, that feeling. And he was a Korean American guy, and he turned out to be sober. His name is Sam. And this is very rare, by the way, to find a sober person, especially, you know, young and kind of hip or whatever. You're not somebody who's very, very old and who's a chronic alcoholic, is what I'm trying to say. And I was like, really? And we became friends. I'm still friends with Sam to this day. He visited me in Scotland last year. He's an AA guy. You know, I'm not an AA person, although I definitely align with a lot of values. And that friendship really helped me getting out and exploring. I started to travel around Korea. I bought a bike. I cycled along the east coast of Korea right up to the North Korean border because, you know, after my kind of past, I wasn't just going to go and sit in a room and do yoga and nothing else.
No, you had to head towards the worst, the most demilitarized zone in the world.
Yeah, that, you know, so that's the kind of stuff that I did, and that just really helped me. And I suppose what happened was I started to reap the benefits in such a way that started to become more important than this thing that I used to do that I didn't value anymore. And I suppose it's like the scale kind of tips in the other direction. And now I've got too much to lose by going back on that decision.
Mm. Well, this is, I suppose, so much of what I've been talking about in the last couple of episodes is, you know, when we get into drinking or drugs or, you know, a form of numbing or escaping, you know, we become adrift from, you know, not just our emotions, because we're doing everything we can to kind of block those out, and reality, because again, we're trying everything we can to block that out. It's just we become adrift from ourselves and adrift from our values. And then we can sort of wake up one day and go, I don't even fucking know who I am, you know, and I don't know what I want to do. And I don't know how I got here. And I don't know I don't know what my values are now. Or maybe you can have a sense of what your values are, because I think deep down we do know that, but it's more a case of, I don't know where I became so adrift, so detached from them. Now, we've talked a little bit before, and you've mentioned this thing about radical integrity to me, which I think is a fantastic term, because straight away it's going to, you know, talks to what we're looking at really, which is about, you know, being yourself and living in complete alignment with your values. Is this something that just when you're cycling along east coast of South Korea, or, you know, and you're sort of working out who you don't want to be anymore and thinking about what you do want to do with your life, how did this sort of principle of radical integrity show up for you? How does that show up for you?
You know, it's something that I've really been contemplating only in the past year or so, and I'm coming up to actually next week 9 years sober, and you would think that I had that all sorted. It's not the case. For me, as somebody who has self-abandoned my own values, you could say, often throughout life, radical integrity is something for me that it's really about holding myself accountable, checking in with myself. Because it's so easy, these kind of self, and I hate to use, you know, the jargon or whatever, but these kind of self-abandoning behaviors, they're so mechanical that even if I know that's not what I want, or that's not the kind of person I want to be with, you know, the body is just used to and gets into these habits. So for me, radical integrity is really just about checking in with myself. Does this align with my values, this behavior, even this way of thinking, and yeah, holding myself accountable. And yeah, I mean, my whole journey since getting sober has been about that, even if I haven't maybe known how to vocalize it in that way. But now I am more strict about it, you know?
And how are you strict about it? So for example, you know, when you say it's about checking in and making sure that what you're doing is aligned to your values, that sounds like a very conscious, deliberate, frequent process, you know, a habit. And is that what it is? I mean, how does, do you have daily practices? Do you have, you know, mindsets that help you maintain that discipline of checking in?
Okay, so for me, this is about listening often to my body. And I know you might be thinking, whatever, heard that before.
No, I'm really interested in this. Go on. Listening to your body.
Yeah, so since I've stopped numbing out and I've been able to actually feel sensations in my body, which took a while, often if I'm, for example, if I'm voicing a plan or something that I want to do, and that's maybe not something that I should pursue, or perhaps it's just something that's not going to happen, I feel that in my body. I feel a tightness often in my throat. I feel a tightness in my stomach. So what my body is telling me is, don't take that any further. Okay. And so there's lots of things that I want to do that will produce that feeling in my body. So radical integrity for me would be listening to that and saying, okay, I'm getting that sign from my body. Even though I really want to do this thing, I'm going to put that on hold right now. Because even though I don't know why, the message I'm getting here is not to do it. And that is really hard when you want to do the thing, especially when you don't have the reason why, because there isn't, you might not ever know that. Often you find out down the line. And because I'm someone who's always coming up with lots of ideas and projects and lots of things. So this is one way in which I check in. Even my trip abroad, or, you know, I've been wanting to move abroad for years. I've been, you know, all these experiences that I've talked to you about, all of a sudden I find myself in Scotland, pregnant as a single mom, no dad on the scene. I'm in this one place and I'm like screaming, I just want to get out and go on adventures, you know, even with my daughter. And anytime I want to put something like that in place, I got this feeling in my body telling me, not yet, wait. And I've had to.
That's interesting. That's interesting. That's the sort of, that's not a never. That's just a sort of not yet. The time's not right though, sort of thing. Yeah. So I suppose what you're saying though is when you're not in alignment with your values, when something doesn't feel right to you, you can feel attuned. You get this feedback system, feedback mechanism from your body that you can now listen to that you would have never even recognized as being there before. And it can help you make those sort of critical decisions. I'm assuming as well that there's a very positive feedback mechanism when you're in alignment and you know instantly that something is right, or intuitively gut feel that something is right. You also feel the powerful, no holds barred, wholehearted, I'm in.
Yes, it does work that way as well. And it, more of a spaciousness and lightness about that decision. And, you know, things flow easier to make that happen. Unfortunately, there's also a lot of in-between areas where it doesn't necessarily feel like a full-bodied yes. Or sometimes I don't get that feeling either, the kind of contracting feeling. And that's where a lot of the confusion comes in. And I know a lot of people struggle with this, you know, they're like, well, what to do? And I also experienced that.
Yeah, well, I think it's, you know, I think the... one of the things I've been talking about again on this podcast recently is about that sort of the relationship that you can have with your emotions, the relationship that you can have with your body, the relationship that you can have with the world at large. And you can feel in a line, you know, the messages that you can get from it if you're tuned in, if you take the time to sort of tune in. And sometimes for people that's, you know, practices, that's 10 minutes of meditation, or it's 20 minutes of journaling, or it's just, you know, how do I feel right now? What do I need right now? What's the best and most wonderful thing I could do for myself right now? And sometimes it does come through journaling prompts and discipline. But I think what we're talking about here as well is it can just sometimes just feel instinctive, and it can feel immediate. And I guess feeling these things isn't necessarily going to tell you what to do with it. You know, as you say, it sort of says, this is a flag. This is a red flag for stuff that's not aligned. This is a green flag for stuff that is. It doesn't tell you what the plan is. It just tells you yes or no. Still got to go and figure it out.
Yeah, exactly. And the way I see it is, you know, perhaps the big decisions are something that I definitely should not go ahead with. I would feel it most then, but then all that kind of in between that I spoke about there that I don't feel it with, and it's not that clear. You know, maybe there is a lot of flexibility there to do it various different ways, and it, you know, the stakes are not that high if you choose that or that, or do you know what I mean? But whenever it's something that I definitely a road I should not pursue, then that's when it comes into play.
I love this conversation though, because what it's sort of solidifying in my mind is that in this, in sort of integrity, is not about perfection, and it's not about having it all worked out. It's about honesty. And then it's about courage, because sometimes, you know, it's the things that you feel aligned to do are still hard. And that can be, you know, wanting to put something on the back burner that you feel really, really, I want to do this, but it doesn't feel right at the moment. That's also courageous to say, actually, no, don't run this time.
Yeah.
Stay put and just be. This isn't the right time. The right time will reveal itself. But it's not right now. It's not a bad idea. It's just not right now.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's why this trip came up. That actually felt good, you know. It wasn't such a permanent thing. It's just a little adventure for Saf and I.
Yeah, no, that's, I want to talk about that, because that sounds absolutely fab. But before we talk about that, let's just sort of chronologically, when did you decide that, or realize rather, that travel and sobriety, so this thing that you love, travel, and this place that you found yourself in, sobriety, could actually come together and be a business? Because although you're sort of moving on to other things now, temporarily, or for who knows for how long, We Love Lucid was fantastically successful and is pioneer in the travel, sober travel, alcohol-free travel world. When did you go, there's something in this from a business perspective?
I mean, I'm going to be honest with you. I'm not a natural business person. I've always just done things that have felt good to me. And so I was in Spain. This was at the end of my big trip that I did after Korea, my big sober trip when I traveled the world and did all these amazing things or bucket list things that I'd want to do. I ended up in the south of Spain, and it was somebody there, a friend, that suggested this to me about doing the alcohol-free trips. And I just remember listening when he first said it, I was like, no, that sounds awful.
Why did you think it sounded awful?
The reason why I thought it sounded awful was because at that time there wasn't this like burgeoning sober community online, nothing about that.
Right.
I suppose my idea of any kind of sober group would have just been, the only thing point of reference I had was AA, and this is in no way to say anything negative about AA, but you know, the visual that I had of that was people sitting around, because you see it in movies, you know, I'm sure I was exposed to that growing up in movie, people sitting around, everyone very depressed, talking about these awful things. And I know that's not actually the way it is in AA now, but so I was like, what? So that's what it'd be like. I'd bring people to a place, or I'd bring people to a place, and everyone would sit around and talk about how awful their life is. And so it took me a while to develop a new vision of what that could be. And, you know, sort of taking reference from my own trips that I had and how I felt in my own big trip that I'd done, where I went to Mongolia and Siberia and I swam with sharks. And so, yeah, over time I developed a vision that I thought, wow, this actually could be, I could create something really attractive here and that could work really well. And it was after my first trip that I did that I was blown away by the degree to which people on the trip bonded so quickly. And I later worked out that was because of the vulnerability, the shared vulnerability. You know, when you just get a group of people going away on a normal trip, they might not share that vulnerability of having done something really hard, or, you know, even making that bold decision to quit drinking in a society which requires drinking. And so I thought, wow, this is brilliant. This is really special. And since then, it's been like that in most of the trips. There's people that have remained friends or still friends to this day, and people that have come back on the trips.
So I was actually going to ask you about, you know, how you went about designing experiences that feel really abundant and really exciting without alcohol. But actually, you've just explained that it's not necessarily about designing that into the type of experience. It's about the vulnerability and the nature, the spirit of the people who come on those trips that create that abundance and create that depth of meaning. You know, you're not sort of saying, oh, I must design fun into this trip. The people who go on those trips, who've gone through the journeys that they've gone through and are now surrounded in the sort of wonderful environments that you put them in, naturally bring that abundance and bring that colour and bring that excitement themselves. The old depth, I suppose, is what you're talking about as much as anything.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And even though that is true, there is also a lot of lot to be said for designing of these kind of trips, because you do have to do it in a certain way, or there is a certain way to do it, and that can really promote this kind of feeling of bonding. And it's all really a lot about that sensory experience. You know, sober people love profound sensory experiences. And what I found was adding that element of adventure also really helped, because not only you've got these people that have this shared vulnerability, but they're trying something new and something difficult together. So we did windsurfing in a couple of our trips, and it's actually quite tricky to get to nail that. Maybe you've tried it, and you know, whenever people try this hard thing together, that it also adds to that whole bonding experience. You know, they feel good about themselves. I suppose an extreme example of this would be people going through any challenge or difficult situation together often bonds them. And but also lots of time outdoors, because these are all things that I picked up from my trip when I went to Mongolia and Siberia, all these things that I found really, really healing as a sober person. So all of these things, and I suppose it's something I'm naturally quite good at, putting together these trips, having done lots of them myself, and I'm really good at organizing, I suppose. So there you go, it all just kind of worked worked well together.
I think one of the things I always say to people is once you've kicked alcohol into touch and you've literally done something which can feel as difficult and as challenging and as insurmountable as that, you do actually feel like you are capable of anything. So actually, when you start looking at travel and someone says, how about, you know, windsurfing, or how about some canyoning, or how about this, or have you ever climbed a 10,000 meter, you know, whatever, then you can start going, no, I think I can. Because you actually start, if I can do that, I can do anything. And it gives you that sense of I am capable. It certainly takes the blinkers off as to what holidays should traditionally, in sort of in a world of sort of conformed package holidays, you know, what holidays should all be about. It completely opens the world back up, I think, which is brilliant. And I think the mistake that a lot of people make is that they give up drinking and then they get worried about their summer holidays because they're going to go off and do the same summer holiday as they used to do as a drinker. So all the same triggers, all the same cues, all the same, you know, habit loops are bound to come up because you're going to be doing exactly the same thing. But this time you're going to be breaking the pattern of a lifetime and not doing it with a drink in hand. And I'd always say to people, well, don't do that then. You know, do something different.
Yeah.
Go and do a different type of holiday, the kind of holiday that you would, you know, that doesn't invite drinking, that you can't do if you're drinking, that you need to be in good peak shape. You're going to be getting up in the mornings. You're going to be going and doing stuff that's incongruous with drinking. Just go and do something different because you're different now. You're different. So go and do different. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. I think a lot of that is to do with this new concept when you get sober of meeting your needs.
Yes.
You know, because for so long you just neglect your needs at all. So I'm sober now. I'm going to go on holiday. What do I really need? Do I really need, you know, the same kind of holiday with the same people and the same triggers? Or do I need something that's really going to facilitate my sobriety journey and then try to meet that need? It's just one example, and it's something sober people are just so unfamiliar with to varying degrees, and it just falls into that. But I would definitely say it's worth it. You know, you're just making life a lot easier for yourself as well.
And I think that one of the things that I really realized, you know, when I sort of stopped drinking 5 years or so ago, is for the first few holidays I just wanted something restorative. You know, I wanted something calm, and I wanted to, you know, keep doing that kind of work on myself, which is all about just calming everything down and just realizing that there was a sort of a more present way of doing stuff. And then in the last couple of years, although I haven't actually done this kind of holiday, I have come to realize I need more vumph. You know, I need more excitement. So that could be, 1 year it's a sort of a more of a retreaty restorative thing. The next time it can be some kind of adrenaline fueled, you know, high as a kite on the natural dopamine kind of thing. But it's about going, what do I need right now? And what's the kindest thing that I can do for myself right now? And I think that's the question that I always encourage people to ask every time they have a drinks craving. You know, what do I need right now? What do I really need? What's the kindest thing I could do to fulfill this need? But it applies to the bigger, you know, the bigger questions about what's the next stage of my life? You know, what kind of, from what holiday do I want to go on to? You know, how do I want to spend the next 6 months? You know, what feeds me? What's going to nourish me? Really, really important. So two things I want to really quickly talk about, not really quickly, but I want to move on to quickly. The first is your pending travel. Your camper van and your daughter sounds incredibly exciting. And also your writing, which I find incredibly exciting. And I know has played a very large part of, you know, your life, not just the blogging, but, you know, just writing in general. So talk to me a little bit about how that's showing up for you at the moment, your writing.
Yeah, well, basically what happened was when I started We Love Lucid, I kept going to write these articles, which started off something like, oh, top 10 tips, blah, blah, blah. And anytime I went to do that, I automatically just started back into writing about these stories, you know, whether it was about my experience in South Africa, staying in this crazy house, you know, the guy lived in the shed with a shotgun and the old with the army guy, or, you know, so, and it kept going in that direction. It was like something was telling me, okay, you've got some stories to tell here, and why don't you follow that train of thought? And then over time, because I was running We Love Lucid, and you know, people look up to me as a person who's responsible, they're taking them away on this holiday, and I often felt that I couldn't write authentically the way that I really love to write, which is just really authentically, and it's quite raw, and it's, you know, a lot of the experiences that I've had, most people don't have those. And you know, that you could say that's a good thing or a bad thing. So I'm sharing these kind of often quite dramatic and extreme experiences that I've had, and I feel compelled to write about them in my own unique way. But ultimately, what I'm writing about, they're not, these are not unique thoughts. The thoughts and feelings that kind of underpin these experiences are universal. And this is the same, goes the same for every writer. The reason why their work appeals to people is because what they're sharing are universal feelings and thoughts, that only they're doing it in their own very unique way.
Yeah,
that's the thing. And some people really relate to my kind of writing. Other people are like, oh my god, I can't believe she said that, that's just so, oh my goodness. And I do get people responding to some of my emails. Like I think I wrote my newsletter recently about one of my cats that died when I was young in the country, and you know, it wasn't a lovely story, I'll just put it like that. You know, she was obviously a cat lover, and she just was outraged at this. And you know what? I'm not going to apologize for it. I just told a story from my childhood, and that's just my, you know, I love animals too, but that's just one example. And how as a writer, I write for me. I don't write for other people. I write what comes through me, what I feel compelled to write. And because I think, you know, that's what artists, the whole thing about creating art is about. And so that's where I am right now. And I couldn't tell you why I've been compelled to write about these stories. I could hazard a guess and say because it maybe helps or inspires people, but ultimately I'm doing it because I feel compelled to.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, obviously, you know, much of what is written about in the world is popular and resonates with people because it taps into these universal truths, and people can kind of go, I can relate to that. But it is the style in which individual writers write that makes it unique. And I've been sort of struggling to sort of sum up, because I'm not a writing critic, as you would imagine. I've been sort of struggling, sort of trying to sort of sum up what I would express as your sort of style of writing. And for me, I think it sort of blends this honesty and rawness, and there's reflection, and there's curiosity, and there's sort of reminiscing about your travels when you were evidently still a drinker, but now also a very sort of clear-eyed look at life without alcohol. But there's a thread that runs through both either the sort of the sober times or the non-sober times, which is this idea of sort of the spirit of wonder. There's a big human interest in your writing as well. You know, whether you're talking about that guy in South Africa, or, you know, you're talking about the various scenes that you found yourself in, riots or sort of fighting and stuff in various places. I think you've got there's a very human aspect to your writing as well. And it touches me. I haven't read the piece about the cat, I have to say. But it does touch me because I think it is, as you say, it's a sort of personal essays plus travelogue. It's always rooted in a place. And I mean, that could be Latin America, but it could also be your teenage years. But it's always sort of circling, I think, even though you don't necessarily call it out openly, I think it always sort of circles back to this idea of questions about yourself, questions about the world, questions about people, culture, dynamics. And I find it fascinating. I really do. I would recommend anyone to go and have a look at your blog, and we'll put the link in the notes for sure. You're going to read us something.
Yes, I would. Just one other note I'd like to add, just before I do that. For me, I'm sadly interested in this kind of interface between tragedy and humor. And I use a lot of humor in my writing, but also, you know, talking about things that some people might be like, oh my God, that's awful. How could you, you know? And I'm really interested in this in general, you know, when it comes even to death and dying and these kind of experiences. And I honestly think that humor is a cathartic way of getting through these experiences. Like growing up in Northern Ireland during the Troubles, people often used to joke in ways that anyone who had not grown up in that scenario would find really abhorrent, or, you know, places like Bosnia and other places that I've heard people use that kind of humor. And so for me, the sober humor definitely is a big part of my writing. This the piece that I'm going to read to you now, it's not humorous. You might find just some of the pronunciation of the words in my Northern Irish exact accent might be humorous, but I will stick to my original accent and not go general. Yeah, this piece is called The Freedom to Choose. What does sober mean to you? Sober is no more waking up in a stranger's house with no idea how the hell I got there. It's no more ruining family Christmas dinners, or always being the last one to leave the damn party. It's no more nosebleeds in the shower. Sober is sleep, the kind of sleep I used to get as a kid. It's always remembering what I did the night before. It's appreciating the simple things in life. Sober is clarity. Sober is no more watching my life pass by knowing I'm destined for something better. It's doing the things I loved before I lost myself in the chaos. It's learning who I am all over again. Sober is the beginning of something epic. It's chasing my wildest dreams. Sober is the freedom to choose. Sober is acceptance. It's facing my biggest fears and coming out the other end fiercer and stronger than ever. It's no more berating myself for being less than perfect. It's learning to look in the mirror and say, this is me. It's understanding that not everyone will like me, and that's okay. Sober is no more wondering when my life is going to begin for real. It's realizing that no one is coming to save me. Sober is no more excuses. It's learning to choose me. It's realizing that it's all about the long game. Sober is connection. It's being there for the ones that need me most. It's no more looks of disappointment from the ones I love. Sober is raw dog in life. It's learning to dance in the pissing rain. It's realizing that the hard times don't last, and it's keeping going against the odds. Sober is no more avoiding the pain. It's learning to weather the storm. It's about making the most out of this one and only life. It's knowing that whatever happens, I'm going to be just fine. Sober is saying yes to life. Sober is the freedom to choose.
Amen. I love that. I absolutely love that. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
And read beautifully in your Northern Irish accent, I would say, as well. Thank you very much indeed. Really inspiring, actually. And you know what? I want to leave it there. I wanted to talk about your pending travels, but we're going to run out of time and we're not going to do it justice. So I want to reserve the rights to have you back on the show when you're back from your camper van, because I honestly, you know, the reason I contacted you in the first place was I heard about the fact that you were off on these travels. And I thought, well, there's a lady, you know, walking the walk, taking the time off to do some radical integrity at the right time in life with your daughter at the right age in life. And I just thought, you know, that sounds like an adventure to talk about. But maybe we talk about it when you've done it.
Mm. Yeah, sure.
Because that sounds good. That sounds amazing to me. How long are you going to be away for?
I'm not sure. It's all very vague.
Okay. Brilliant. I love that.
The Vegas plan imaginable.
Brilliant. Okay. I love that. Okay. Thank you so much. I'm going to just sum up by saying, you know, I think you've probably shown us that reconnection isn't necessarily about grand gestures and perfect answers. It starts with that honesty and a sense of curiosity and just taking sort of small steps back to yourself, really. And maybe I think that's an invitation to everybody listening today to notice when we feel out of alignment and to begin, however gently, that process of working out what it is you value and finding your way back. Pretty cool.
Yeah, I love that.
All right, well, thank you. You've come back and talked to us about your travels. I'd love that. And will you be blogging whilst you're away?
Now, that's the idea. Yes, I might move over to Substack. But feel free to sign up to my newsletter anyway for now, and then I'll be letting people know about what I'm going to be doing with that.
Cool. So if everybody wants to go to welovelucid.com, and then there's The blog is on there, and I'm pretty sure that as soon as you click on that, you get the right to sort of sign up to a newsletter anyway, don't you? So it's a really easy process, and the link will be in the show notes.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, sounds good.
Amazing, Lauren. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your experiences with us.
Okay, thank you, Anna. It's been brilliant.
Thank you for listening and getting curious. Please rate, review, and follow this podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you're choosing to listen. And don't forget to tune in to the next episode. And you can find out more about the Big Drink Rethink by heading to my website, thebeliefscoach.com. That's the beliefs, B-E-L-I-E-F-S coach.com, where you will see clear links to the show.